The final investigator I met with was Dr. William McGuire, and to begin our conversation, I asked for his perspective on the most discussed paper of the year in the field, the GOG-218 bevacizumab trial.
I think that for a upfront trial, and let's leave aside cost for a minute, that we really need to show an overall survival advantage. So as far as what the implications does it have for private practice, well, that's what I'm in. So if I put on my clinical trials hat, I think the jury is still out on the addition of Bev either with cytotoxic chemotherapy or in a maintenance phase. What do I do in my own clinical practice? It depends on the patient and how hard the patient is pushing me. I mean, patients are reading the literature now. They are reading all the stuff that comes out in the lay press. And a lot of people come to me and say, well, I want to get bevacizumab. That's just looking at the scientific part of it. If we look at the pharmacoeconomic part of it, which people are just beginning to do, I know when I first added paclitaxel to standard chemotherapy, which eventually did become the new standard of care with the addition of paclitaxel, I got a lot of flack from a lot of people about this is not the standard of care and it costs too much money. Well, it did at that point in time before the drug paclitaxel went generic. It was about $35,000 per patient life year saved. To put that into context with bevacizumab, we're talking in the order of $300,000 to $350,000 per patient life year saved if, in fact, those progression-free survival curves translate into a survival advantage. So I think the jury is clearly still out on whether or not one should use that in everyday practice.
So for practical purposes, if you see a patient now who fits the criteria for going on this study, will you bring it up to them as an option? Will you bring it up and say, I want you to know about this, but I don't think you should have it? How do you sort of shade the way you do ever use it?
I say that in the spirit of keeping you apprised of what's new, here's what's new, but I certainly put the spin on it that what I just told you, the jury is still out. It is extraordinarily expensive, but if in fact your insurance company will bite the bullet and pay for the drug, I think the one thing I didn't mention is that the downside of the drug is minimal. The side effects of the drug, hypertension, which can almost always be controlled with a calcium channel blocker. Some patients have proteinuria. There's been very few patients that have developed proteinuria at the nephrotic level that have required discontinuation of the drug. And the third and major concern that people have had with the drug is bowel perforation. But point in fact is the initial studies that showed bowel perforation rates from about 3 to 11% were in patients that had recurrent, oftentimes large volume disease. And in this specific trial, the bowel perforation rates were identical in all three of the arms. So you expect people that have intra-abdominal malignancy to occasionally develop bowel perforation as part of the disease process. And I think that in the trial was in fact a comforting measure that we did not see an excessive number of bowel perfs in the group that got the bevacizumab.
Although I guess maybe there was like 1% difference. It wasn't completely identical, I think.
Right, but it was pretty close.
It was under 3%
right.
In all three groups. Well, not sure I still have quite the answer of will you do it or not. What about the patient you just mentioned who says, you know, money's no object. I've heard about it. Will you give it to me?
I will. I will give it to her, because it may translate into a survival advantage for that patient. It's the same way I feel about intraperitoneal therapy. I mean, there are three trials of IP therapy that suggest, all of which suggest either a progression-free or an overall survival benefit. Do I mention it? I usually mention it. I tend to not mention it or mention it only in passing in certain groups of patients. For example, people that have large volume disease left behind, because I don't think that IP therapy makes sense in somebody with large volume residual disease, nor do I mention it much in a patient that has diabetic neuropathy or a patient that has alcoholic neuropathy, because the big bugaboo of current IP therapy is fairly significant peripheral neuropathy.
Anything else you want to say about that study in bevacizumab?
Well, I think that to some extent, I mean, obviously I'm driven by clinical trials, and so I first and foremost try to get my patients on clinical trials. In the current replacement trial for that study that was just released at ASCO this year has bevacizumab in every arm, and in fact has maintenance bevacizumab in every arm. So the GOG has already bought the outcome of that trial, even though the outcome of the trial is not there yet. And I'm not being critical of the GOG. I mean, oftentimes when you do clinical research, you have to use a leapfrog approach. And so if you hadn't put the Bev in there and there turns out to be a survival advantage, and then you've got 1,000 patients on a trial without Bev, then somebody's going to come back to you and say, well, you know, you didn't use the standard of care in your control arm, and therefore we can't interpret the results of the new trial. So sometimes you're damned if you do and damned if you don't.
How do you go about deciding on a regimen for patients with so-called platinum-sensitive disease?
I think the carbopaclitaxel, I put at the bottom of the list, mainly because of the toxicity profile. A lot of these people have persistent neuropathy to some degree, and if you give carbopaclitaxel, you're certainly going to add to the neurotoxicity. You cause hair loss, which isn't a big deal, but it's a big deal for somebody that's just 12 months following primary therapy and their hairs come back. Carbogemcitabine does not cause the neuropathy, does not cause the hair loss, but is somewhat tough to get in from the point of view of hematologic toxicity, particularly platelets, and some respiratory things, some shortness of breath without pulmonary infiltrates that can be bothersome to the patient and to the doctor trying to figure out what's going on. And many of those patients are not able to be treated at the doses that were used in the German trial. You oftentimes have to back down on both the carbo and the gemcitabine doses. The carbodoxal is a nice regimen because it doesn't cause neuropathy, it doesn't cause hair loss, does not cause significant count suppression, and is a Q4 week rather than a Q3 week schedule. So for the patient that has recurrent platinum-sensitive disease and is still active, it's probably the least noxious of the three. It was compared to carbopaclitaxel. Nobody has actually compared carbodoxal and carbogemcitabine, but I'm reasonably certain if one did, that from the blood count point of view, it would be easier to get in the carbodoxal.
You mentioned shortness of breath with gemcitabine carbo. What do you think the mechanism is?
We have no idea. But in the previous GOG huge trial that was published in Journal of Clinical Oncology, the five-arm trial that looked at sequential doublets versus triplets, published by Bookman about a year ago, that was carbopaclitaxel as a baseline, two gemcitabine-based regimens. One was carbogemcitabine doublet times four, followed by carbopaclitaxel times four. And then another regimen was the triplet carbopaclitaxel and gemcitabine given for eight cycles. And in both of the gemcitabine-containing regimens, there was a significant increase in respiratory complaints in terms of dyspnea, et cetera, but without pulmonary infiltrates. And that's been seen in other studies as well. It clearly causes some type of pulmonary toxicity. And occasionally, I think the early data in lung cancer actually showed some fatal pulmonary processes that were not ever felt to be some type of toxic pneumonitis that eventually led to decline in pulmonary function, requiring intubation, and then ARDS and death, I mean, in a few cases. So there is some pulmonary toxicity there that I don't think is well worked out.
Let's talk about some of your patients. How about your 68-year-old woman?
This is a woman who presented to me about 2.5-3 years ago. Is actually a physician that had typical symptoms. She's in her late 60s, a little older than the average, high-grade serous cancer, but was optimally debulked and then referred to me. And we went through all of the IP stuff, and the Armstrong data had, I don't remember whether it had just been published or was soon to be published, and I knew the results. And so I said, here's the latest, greatest in terms of IP therapy. You don't have any things that absolutely contraindicate using this therapy, but it's potentially toxic, and went through particularly the neurotoxicity. And she said, let's go for it. And she got a total of 5 regimens. It was quite toxic for her, quite toxic for her husband, quite toxic for the nursing staff. In the AOC, she had to, you know, the Armstrong regimen is day 1, day 2, day 8. And she typically also had to come in oftentimes on days 3 and 4 for fluids. She lived in Washington, D.C., and I'm in Baltimore, so it was a 1-hour drive each way. So it was tough on her. And then we backed off on cycle 6 and gave her IV paclitaxel carbo because at that time she had peripheral neuropathy that was worrisome and bothersome to me and was bothering her to the point that she was having some unsteadiness of gait, particularly at night, getting up and going to the bathroom. And so she got the 6 cycles. She had a reasonably strong family history of breast and ovary cancer, was of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, was BRCA tested, and as you might expect, it turned out to be BRCA positive, but luckily has not recurred. And I just saw her recently, and she still has a CA125 of 4 or 5 and a CT scan within the last year, which I don't necessarily ascribe to, but the GYN oncologist that follows her along with me likes to get them. I guess it makes him feel better. CT scan was negative. And is she doing better than expected? Yes, because she's older and these patients tend to be the ones that recur early, but she is also BRCA1 positive and so exquisitely more sensitive to platinum therapy, we know now. And I think it's now quite clear why there was the discrepancy in outcome for BRCA-positive breast cancer versus BRCA-positive ovarian cancer, as we've now learned more about the BRCA gene and it being closely in association with at least 2 of the 3 platinum repair mechanisms on chromosome 17, that when you get those mutations, you often mutate out the platinum resistance genes as well. And so these people are exquisitely more sensitive to platinum. The problem with the BRCA1 breast cancer is that up until very recently, platinum was not part of the treatment regimen.
You said it was very difficult for her in terms of the IP treatment. Has she gotten back to where she was before the beginning of treatment?
Well, she's not back to where she started yet in terms of the neuropathy. She still has persistent neuropathy. And she's now one of those interesting cases. In fact, when she came to see me last week, her husband was with her. And what she is going through right now is what I call survivor guilt. She feels very guilty about the fact that she is still, well, she is only now back working about 50% time. She confided in me just last week that she rarely goes out. Her husband has a lot of social responsibilities, and she used to be very used to going out with him and just doesn't do that anymore. Even though if you ask her, is it fatigue? Well, there's a little bit of fatigue, but I don't really want to go out. People say, oh, you look so well, and I don't really want to talk about that, and I feel guilty about the fact that I'm still alive, and some of the people that I knew that got treated when I got treated are dead, and I've still got this neuropathy that bothers me. And so she's still having a tough time, even though I think as we get further and further out, it's less and less likely that she's going to have a recurrence and succumb to her ovarian cancer and probably succumb to something else.
Yeah, I saw that comment in your note about, quote, survivor dread and guilt.
Right.
In terms of, quote, survivor guilt, how often do you see that?
It's quite common if you ask about it. The problem is that, well, you don't get survivor guilt, obviously, in somebody who's developed recurrent disease if, in fact, the physician is being honest with them and saying, you know, that, and, you know, let's face it, most women with ovarian cancer still, even though they may have a complete remission, still eventually develop recurrent disease. And when that happens, then the discussion is, okay, well, I go through platinum sensitivity and platinum resistance, and I say, you know, let's think about this now as a chronic disease, just like any other chronic disease that internists take care of. And you may still succumb to something other than ovarian cancer, but there's a very high likelihood you will succumb to ovarian cancer. And right now, my goal as your physician is to keep this disease at bay with as little muss and fuss as possible. So that's the typical patient, but the patient who is doing well, you know, these women all see each other down in the clinic and they get to know each other and they become friends. And even when they're no longer getting chemotherapy, they're emailing each other. And as more and more of their cohort develop recurrent disease, they begin to really feel very guilty about the fact that they're still doing well. They're happy that they're disease-free, but there's a certain guilt there that I think is worth exploring. And I try to have all of these patients seen by our psychosocial oncologist, who is a full-time employee in our cancer institute, who does deal with these kinds of issues.
That's interesting. What about the term survivor dread?
Survivor dread is, when is the shoe going to fall? You know, all of these people that I know, their cancer has come back and mine hasn't come back yet. And as more and more of their friends develop recurrent disease, they become more and more convinced that they're in fact going to have recurrent disease as well. And when's it going to happen? And so it kind of becomes the dread. My friend over in London has talked about the patients with CA125 addiction, and it truly is an addiction. I mean, they begin to become tachycardic and have this dread before the CA125 is checked. And the minute the CA125 is drawn, they literally begin calling the next day or sometimes the same day as my CA125 back. And as soon as it's back and okay, then the tachycardia goes away and they're fine for the next 3 months. But then you also have the people where the CA125 goes from 5 to 6 and they are convinced they've got recurrent ovarian cancer. And so I spend way too much time I have a kind of a script that I give to them right now, which says, you know, I'm not going to react to a CA125 unless there is a persistent and consistent trend upwards, and then we'll do a scan. So we spend an awful lot of time dealing with the fear of recurrence.
How about your 51-year-old woman?
Well, this is a woman who basically was a picture of health. Actually came from a family where she was basically involved with her family to a huge extent because 2 of her 3 children had juvenile onset diabetes and 2 of her 3 children had cystic fibrosis. And so she had spent most of her life trying to keep her kids alive so they could go to school. She had 3 sons and was a health nut and ran every day. And she started having some right upper quadrant pain that was persistent and went to see her physician. And to make a long story short, she had about a 5-centimeter mass in the right lobe of her liver, turned out to be a metastatic lesion from a serous ovarian cancer, underwent a major debulking both by a GYN oncologist and a surgical oncologist simultaneously, had resection of the right lobe of her liver and debulking and primary treatment with a very long treatment-free interval, some 20, close to 2 years after the Armstrong regimen, the IP regimen, which she got in a 14-month interval, was placed on carboplatin and gemcitabine, which was a rational doublet for platinum-sensitive disease. The German data had come out at that point in time. Tolerated that reasonably well. Again, had to have some dose reductions in both the carbo and the gemcitabine, if I remember, because of platelet counts. And had another about 14-month interval and has now progressed another time. And this coming week will begin on the carboplatin and Doxil doublet. So this is the classic example of what I call chronic ovarian cancer. Her original treatment was completed over 3 years ago. And other than getting that therapy, which caused some neuropathy, which is now resolved completely, and a little bit of count suppression with 6 cycles of carboplatin and gemcitabine, has continued to live a perfectly normal life and see 1 kid graduate from college, another kid start college. And I would anticipate this woman may well live another 3 or 4 years with her ovarian cancer with a, you know, from diagnosis to death in the 8-9 year range. And this is, we see not infrequently in that group of patients. This would be a patient that one would call BRCA-ness. This is a patient who, she's been BRCA-tested as BRCA-negative, but is behaving more like a BRCA-positive patient.
How often do you see patients who can have hepatic metastases resected? How often do you see hepatic metastases?
It's actually fairly uncommon. About 5% of all presentations are with hepatic metastases. The more common stage 4 presentation is with pleural disease, and usually when people have hepatic disease, the outcome is extraordinarily poor. They tend to go downhill very rapidly. So this woman is a bit unusual in that regard.
Is the thinking that this is a hematogenous spread to the liver, or is there ever a thought that it might be somehow contiguous?
I think it's most likely hematogenous because what you typically see is when they develop hepatic metastasis, it's usually multiple hepatic metastasis. So the only real way to make sense out of that is that it's, you know, into the portal circulation or into the hepatic circulation, one or the other.
What extra-abdominal sites of metastasis do you see commonly in ovarian cancer?
Well, lung and pleura and mediastinum, supraclav nodes. Brain is extremely, extremely uncommon. Bone is extremely, extremely uncommon. I see almost exclusively GYN malignancy and have for the last 30 plus years of my private practice. And I think I've seen a total of 3 patients with brain mets and 1 or 2 patients that had documented bony metastatic disease. So it tends to stay in the abdominal cavity, retroperitoneal nodes, splenic hilum, porta hepatis, occasionally hepatic parenchymal mets. More typically, people call it liver mets, but it's not. It's really implants on Glisson's capsule, and sometimes those implants will indent Glisson's capsule and make it look like there's a true parenchymal met in the liver, but all it is a superficial met that's indenting the liver. So that behaves in a totally different way than the true parenchymal liver mets. And then after that, pleura, mediastinum, and supraclavicular nodes, and occasionally the more rare sites.